Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once described Caddyshack as an awesome documentary, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Hey, it's week three of the FedEx playoffs, and it finds the PGA Tour just outside Philadelphia at historic Aronimink for the BMW Championship. But that's not the story this week. No, the story is the Ryder Cup captain's picks. On the American side, Jim Furyk selected his first three of four, and to no one's surprise, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, and the hottest player on the planet off of back-to-back playoff wins, Bryson DeChambeau. On the European side, it's more interesting. Thomas Bjorn eschewed form for experience as Paul Casey, Henrik Stenson, and Sergio Garcia, who's had a dreadful year, were named over players rounding into form like Rafa Cabrera-Bello and Thomas Peters. Now, only time will tell who made the right and wrong moves. But let's face it, that's one of the things we like about the Ryder Cup, eventual captain accountability. Hey, today on the show, we continue our campus tours with Coach Andrew Sapp of the ECU Pirates and Ryan Cabbage of the Charlotte 49ers, previewing their men's squads in fall season. But we begin with one of the finest authors about golf on the planet, John Feinstein. Usually known for his works of nonfiction, John has written a fantastic fictional tale about a 17-year-old who actually has a chance to win the Masters, that is, if he can survive navigating some of the nastiness in the world of amateur golf. It's called The Prodigy. So ever since Bo Hostler went into the lead at the Olympic Club as a high school sophomore several years ago at the U.S. Open, I've had this wild notion, this fantasy, if you will, that amateur golf has gotten so good in this country, and kids are getting so good, so battle-hardened, so polished at such an early age, that it doesn't stretch credulity for me to imagine one actually being in contention at a U.S. Open, at a Masters, at an Open Championship on the weekend. Of course, that's a theme in your book, The Prodigy. Do you think it could happen, or am I just crazy?
No, I don't think you're crazy at all, Charlie, and that's part of the reason why I put together this plot in The Prodigy, because maybe you have to suspend disbelief a little bit to think that a 17-year-old could be in contention on Sunday at the Masters. But remember, the British Open in 2015 at St. Andrews, you had an amateur in the lead after 54 holes, and you had five amateurs in the top 10 after 54 holes, all very young players. Now, none of them won. Zach Johnson ended up winning, as we know. But more and more, you're right, we're seeing young players who have played so much amateur golf and so much college golf come to the fore early in their pro careers or even while they're still amateurs. Jordan Spieth finished T16 at the Byron Nelson when he was 16 in high school. And Ty Tryon, years ago, made it through PGA Tour Q School when he was 17. Probably shouldn't have turned pro, probably should have gone to college, but he was good enough to compete with pros at the age of 17. So when I was writing The Prodigy, my thought was a 17-year-old competing to win the Masters, not likely, but not completely impossible. And that's why throughout the book, you know, I keep quoting Rory McIlroy, who's one of the real people who appears in the book, is saying, hey, you know what? This kid's good enough to win now, not in 5 years or 10 years. He's good enough to win now, because it's not crazy to say something like that.
You mentioned Ty Tryon. To me, he's the ultimate cautionary tale. And you said, you know, he probably should have gone to college. That's something that's repeated over and over again throughout your book as the prodigy, Frank. All he really wants to do is play golf and to go play college golf. And he states it over and over again. And time and again, whether it be Brent Snedeker or other people in the world of golf mentioned to him, Tom Watson, whoever, they all tell him, hey, go to college. Go to college. Right. Is this a universal that you witness out there, that regardless of how good the kid is, all of them say, man, don't grow up so fast. Go to college.
Yes. And I'll tell you why. Because it isn't so much about your ability to play golf inside the ropes. Ty Tryon was good enough, as we said, to get through Q School. There have been other teenagers who have turned pro and been good enough as golfers to compete. But even Tiger Woods, the greatest player of all time, went to Stanford for 2 years and still had all sorts of issues, as we now know, off the golf course at the age of 20. So I don't think there's any doubt. The thing that players say all the time is, if you're good enough, you don't need to turn pro at the age of 18. There's no big rush. And, you know, there's always the temptation if people are throwing a lot of money at you, whether it's Nike or any of the big time shoe companies or any corporate sponsor or people who want to pay you guarantees to play overseas, sure, that money is tempting, especially for parents. But long term, if you're thinking long term about your kid's future, then you don't turn them pro that early. Look what happened to Michelle Wee, you know, who was so good at the age of 13 and turned pro before she went to college and was miserable out there. Only after she went to Stanford did she sort of get her act together and become not a great player because she can't putt, but a good player. Lexi Thompson is somewhat of an exception to the rule. I thought she turned pro too young, but she's been able to handle most of the pressure out there. But she would be the outlier in that.
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. I'm glad you brought up the equipment companies. In a lot of ways, there are themes throughout The Prodigy that read like a cautionary tale. I knew that equipment companies had access to amateurs and can set them up with equipment. One thing that I was unaware of was the access that agents have to kids when they're amateurs. They can come on legally as quote-unquote advisors.
Right.
How much of this is actually going on?
Oh, a lot.
Oh, wow.
A lot. I mean, you see all sorts of play. You know, you go if you go to the NCAA tournament, for example, or if you go to the U.S. Amateur, probably a better example even, you will see agents everywhere. And again, as you said, the rules don't prevent them from having contact with the players. I mean, one of the dumbest things that the NCAA is about to do in basketball is to give agents more access to players than they've had in the past. The theory being that way the sleazy agents won't have an advantage by contacting players while the non-sleazy agents are playing by the rules. Well, I understand that theory, but even the non-sleazy agents are sleazy, Charlie. You know that.
Yes.
So here, excuse me, and in golf, as you said, and as the book says, it's not against the rules. In fact, you know the thing in the book where Frank Baker's dad, Thomas, is going on the payroll of the mythical group Double Eagles, Double Eagle Inc., as a, quote, junior talent scout? That's based on truth.
Because that's
Earl Woods.
Yeah.
Was a talent scout for IMG, quote, unquote, while Tiger was in high school. And the big joke in golf is, hey, he did his job very well. He delivered the greatest junior in history.
I'm glad you brought up the Thomas Baker. He, to me, is one of the most interesting characters in your book. And maybe it's because I'm a dad and my kid plays golf. But at his core, he seems to be a good man who loves his son. They've been a two-man team, basically raised him as a single father. Yet he is the one, not the player, he is the one that is seduced by the dark side of the force, by these advisors. And all his son wants to do is play golf and go to college. I know that this all comes from experience. You write from experience. Is it as sleazy in person to watch these vultures come between families as it is to read?
Yeah, it can be painful because the point I was trying to make in creating Thomas Baker, who in many ways is a composite of many parents, is that you can understand the temptation. You know, when people are throwing money at your feet, people are telling you how great you are, people are telling you how great your child is and how they're going to take care of your child and they're going to make your child a star and you're going to be able to retire and never work again. You can understand the tempting notion there. But this, with Thomas Baker, I think most parents genuinely love their kids and want what's best for their kids, but they can get blinded by what is being thrown at their feet, and by people charming them and sucking up to them and telling them how great they are and that they're never wrong about anything. So I tried in the book to depict the fact that Thomas Baker, the father, is in many ways kind of a tortured figure, because the money is dazzling him. There's no question about it. And he's thinking, I can retire. I can buy a big house in Florida. I can just play golf. I have people lapping up to me all the time. But on the other hand, he's got his son saying, "Dad, I don't want this. This isn't what I want. I want to play golf. I love to play golf, but I want to go to college. I want to be a normal kid. I want to date girls. I want to have a childhood." And that's the danger, is that kids lose their childhoods. And it's not unique to golf. It's worse in tennis. I mean, you have all sorts of tennis players turning pro. In fact, I always ask this trivia question. Do you know who the last American player, male player, to win a Grand Slam tournament who was a college graduate is? If you do, you're very unusual.
McEnroe?
Arthur Ashe.
Ashe.
Who graduated from UCLA in 1963.
Wow.
And I remember asking John McEnroe once why he played Davis Cup all the time. And he said he made his mother two promises when he was in high school. One was to graduate from college, and the other was to play Davis Cup. And he said, "When I dropped out of Stanford after my freshman year, I figured I damn well better play Davis Cup."
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. John, golf is as fiction, I think it's harder to write than other sports, because a field is a field. A basketball court, a football gridiron, a baseball diamond. On the field of play, they are unchanged no matter where you are in the world. Golf is different. Every course is different. And I got to give you great credit here, because the two courses in your book are Riviera and Augusta National, especially Augusta. We all know every nook and cranny of every hole, so it's easy to envision all the action you describe. And the holes that you chose to use at Riviera are iconic ones as well, especially number 10. Was this done on purpose and with that intent in mind?
Absolutely. I hope this book will have broad appeal, but I know a lot of its appeal is going to be to golf fans. And one of the things as a reader that I have always enjoyed in fiction is to read it and say, "Yeah, I've been to the Final Four, so this looks and sounds like a Final Four. I've been to Wimbledon. This looks and sounds like Wimbledon." So in writing fiction about golf, I want a golf fan to say, "Yeah, I know what you mentioned, the 10th hole of Riviera is like. That's always a big featured hole every year during the tournament there, because it's one of the great short par fours in golf, as is number 3 at Augusta National." So I wanted to describe these holes in a way that a golf fan who's either watched on TV or played at Riviera or played at Augusta, if they've been lucky enough to do that, could sit back and go, "Yeah, that's right." People who watch the Masters every year would say, "Yeah, the hole location on Sunday is always front left on 18. So it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. I've covered 27 Masters. I've been to Riviera on many occasions. So I hope I know what I'm talking about."
Just off subject for a second, is it a more fun or calming exercise for you to write fiction than what you normally do in doing the great nonfiction work that you do?
It's very different, Charlie. I'm lucky. I enjoy both. I think by doing both, it keeps me fresh, because I'll finish grinding out a nonfiction book. Like, I have a book coming out on quarterbacking in the NFL in November. And then I know for a while I don't have to go on the road. I don't have to set up interviews. I don't have to try to get people to give me, large chunks of their time, because when I write the fiction, my reporting is done, because my reporting is based on my career and all the years I've spent knowing athletes and coaches and going to all these events we're talking about. And then the challenge is different. The challenge is coming up with a storyline that people are going to want to follow. So I like having a different challenge. I also like the idea that for a few months, my office every day is right here in my house, as opposed to going on the road somewhere. I'm old, Charlie. I like being at home.
John Feinstein is author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. Back to the book for a second. You did change some names, especially where Augusta National was concerned, yep. Much to a big smile on my face, having lived and worked in Augusta for 5.5 years. But there are many real names with actual dialogue and situations used. Did you ask permission in advance, or did you get sort of a tentative okay, but let me read it first? How did you go about that?
When dealing with real characters in all my fiction, almost always they're people I'm friendly with or friends with, and people who I know won't object to having a fictional role in one of my books. Now, I will give them a heads up. You know, I will say, for example, one of the less famous people in the book is Steve DiMeglio from USA Today.
I loved that, by the way.
And Steve's a buddy of mine. And as you notice, every time he appears, the last thing he says is, "I gotta go smoke." And that's because that is always the last thing Steve says to you when you have a conversation with him. So, of course, I gave him a heads up. I gave not only gave Rory McIlroy a heads up, I gave him a copy of the book. And I said, there's a surprise ending. I think you'll like it. But I didn't tell him what it was.
Right.
And all the other guys who appear, from USGA officials, Mike Davis, people like that, to other players, Zach Johnson, Justin Rose, Tom Watson, you mentioned, who, as you know, I'm very close to. I gave them all a heads up that they appear in the book. And I also make sure when I'm dealing with real characters that they don't do anything objectionable.
Right.
Like, I would not have a real character be involved in the incident that takes place at the U.S. Amateur, obviously, in the semifinals. That person had to be fictionalized. And I fictionalized the Augusta National members because, as you know, I kind of make fun of them in the book. And I figure, why get into any kind of battle with them other than saying, hey, fellas, come on, we should all be able to have a good laugh about this. But maybe they'll kick me out. Who knows?
I don't want to give too much away here, but there's a John Feinstein-esque journalist, maybe a young John Feinstein-esque journalist.
Except this guy's a much better golfer than John Feinstein.
He's a big part of the story, and you already brought it up, the fictional playing of the U.S. Amateur, where he, in a couple of ways, becomes unwittingly part of the story.
Right.
The second part is the most egregious, and like I said, I'm not going to give anything away here, but have you ever witnessed a rules infraction or felt like really one may have taken place and you did nothing?
And where I did nothing.
Yes.
Nothing on that level, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There have been moments where I've seen things happen and wondered if I witnessed a rules infraction. And would, you know, eventually ask a rules official, this is what I think I saw, was it a rules infraction? And almost all the time it's not. Players usually know what they're doing. But if I ever witness something like what takes place in Los Angeles in the book, I would feel obligated to do what my fictional character does in the book. You can't allow that to pass if somebody's cheating. I mean, it's an incident involving out-and-out cheating. Most of the time, as you know, when rules get broken, it's inadvertent.
Yes. You rarely, like, again, we're going to give too much away, and I promised I wouldn't do that. John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. The authenticity that permeates your book, I really enjoy, especially, I always like being able to pull back the curtain on Oz for people sometimes and tell them exactly the way things are. And in this case, I think you did this for all of us who have ever hung out in a media tent. You do a tremendous job in detailing the access that the media has with players and at the locations at which we have access at tournaments. Did you do this just as an homage for all of us who have suffered? Or are there places and events that you attend annually that you just loathe for this reason and you had to get it out of your system?
Well, I mean, as you know, Augusta is different than other golf tournaments because it's the only golf tournament in the world where we can't walk inside the ropes.
Right.
I mean, the Augusta National people are very firm on this. Nobody goes inside the ropes other than players and caddies. If a rules official is needed, they call for him or her, and then they come inside the ropes. We don't have access to the champions locker room. We don't have access to the range or the putting green. It makes doing my job harder during Masters week, frankly. But the people at the Masters have a very simple philosophy. It's our golf tournament. We run it the way we want to run it. And if you don't like the way we run it, you are welcome not to come.
That's exactly the
And frankly, I don't have a problem with that.
No.
I mean, it is their golf tournament.
Absolutely.
And as I said, it makes my job harder to do than other weeks on the golf tour. But I go there knowing that. So I go there prepared for that. And you know, I talk about the cell phone rule. In the book, I think the cell phone rule is a little bit ridiculous in today's world where, you know, literally, I remember my friend Dave Kindred walking out of the media center one year, and we were going to the parking lot. We were leaving, and it was 7 o'clock in the evening, maybe later than that. And his wife called. And so instinctively, he reached for his phone. And he got two steps outside and was just about tackled, you know, and was fortunate not to. I mean, if they'd thrown him out that day, it wouldn't have mattered. But I just think they go a little over the top with some of their rules. But again, that's who they are. It's their tournament. If I never show up at Augusta again, believe me, nobody's going to bat an eye. I understand that.
Get you out of here on this. There's so many anecdotes and stories contained within the book, The Prodigy, that ring so true. At the risk of sounding ridiculous, I've got to ask about them. Number one is the great quote from the Palestra: "To win the game is great, to play the game is greater, but to love the game is the greatest of all." And Jordan Spieth incorporates this in a speech to the Drive Chip and Putt kids. It sounds like something so Jordan that I almost want to say, this had to have happened. I know it didn't, but I had to ask, did it happen?
No, I made it up.
Oh, but that, doesn't said, that sound like something he would do, though, John?
Not only does it sound like something he said, he would say, but his brother did play at Brown.
Yes.
So he played in the Palestra for 4 years. So that would give the Spieth family familiarity with the Palestra. So I didn't think it was a stretch to put those words in Jordan's mouth. And I'll use any excuse to get the Palestra into a book, because my wife has always said she's not afraid I will leave her for another woman, but she does worry sometimes I would leave her to move into the Palestra.
And the story of Mike Weir and the shower and hosting the Champions
Dinner.
That's
a true story.
Okay, that is so great. Can you just reiterate that real quick?
The year Mike Weir was the defending champion in 2004, and obviously the defending champion hosts the Champions Dinner on Tuesday night. He picks the menu. He's the host. You know that. That's part of a Masters legend. And on Tuesday night, Mike was on the range grinding on his swing because he was struggling a little bit. And he looked up and looked at his watch, and it was 6:30. The dinner starts at 7. And he went, oh, my God, you know, and he runs into the Champions locker room, which he was in for the first time that year, sweating and desperately needing a shower before he gets dressed. Well, the Champions locker room only has one shower in it because, you know, guys don't take showers all that often. But the night of the Champions dinner, he comes in. Arnold Palmer is in the shower. Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson are waiting for the shower. And as Weir said, that wasn't a line I felt I could cut. He had to wait until each of them was finished with their shower before he could get under the shower, probably for about 2 minutes, and get dressed for the dinner. Fortunately, he only had to walk a few steps to get to the dinner once he had showered. But no, that story's 100% true.
That was fantastic. One quick one here to end it. Your story to me ends on kind of a cliffhanger. Are we to assume that Frank is playing golf for Casey Martin at Oregon?
I think that's a good assumption to make. I do. I think that clearly he could go anywhere he wants. You hope that he'll be playing college golf. And there's a little bit of a cliffhanger in that, as you point out. And I put Casey Martin in the book because he's been so successful as Oregon's golf coach, but also because I got to know Casey when I was doing my Q School book back in 2005, and when he was dealing with the Supreme Court on the golf cart issue. And I've never met a better guy in sports. So, again, I try to incorporate real people who I like and am friends with into these books. So it was kind of natural to put Casey in as a guy who might be recruiting Frank Baker to come play for him.
It's not only a fun read, but for amateurs and their parents, it's a huge cautionary tale. It's called The Prodigy, and that's author John Feinstein. Up next, we continue our annual pre-early season check-ins with some of our local college coaches with Andrew Sapp, head men's golf coach at ECU, and he'll take dead aim at his 2018-2019 Pirates, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Andrew Sapp is entering his second year as the head men's golf coach of the East Carolina Pirates, and we got the chance to catch up this week. What is this I read about your playing prowess rearing its head a couple of weeks ago?
Oh, yeah. Well, played in the club championship and won it. It got a little more press probably than it should have, but it was fun.
I loved it. I loved it. It sends a message to your players, but I also hope you realize that you may have whooped up on some potential donors, and that's not good. Coach, before we get into anything about your team, I got to ask you about something. When we last exchanged messages this summer, I was trying to track down Blake Taylor, who had played at the Greenbrier on the PGA Tour. And you informed me that you were at dinner in Paris for the Palmer Cup. How did this come about, and what were you doing?
Well, I just finished up my tenure as the Golf Coaches Association of America president, and that was my last event, actually. And the Golf Coaches Association puts on the Arnold Palmer Cup, and so I was out there helping to run the event. So it was a fantastic event. Evian, France, and the golf course there is spectacular. It's gorgeous. And to be able to be with the best men and women amateurs in the world was just a lot of fun. And it really, I learned a lot just watching them, which was really cool to see the types of things that they did from a practice and playing standpoint. I actually got to play with a couple in the college am, so that was a lot of fun as well.
Coach, is it my imagination or have I just forgotten? I didn't remember the Palmer Cup being co-ed. Is that something that's recently happened or am I just ignorant?
No, this was the first year. This was the first year that it was not only men and women, but it was the United States versus the world as opposed to just the United States versus Europe. So there were 21 different countries represented at this year's Arnold Palmer Cup, which is obviously the most ever. So it really takes a look at who the best amateur college players are in the world. I mean, we had probably, I think, the top four women amateurs in the world rankings were there, and like seven of the top 12 men, I think, in the world amateur rankings were there. So it was about as good of an amateur field as you'll see on both sides.
Andrew Sapp is the head men's golf coach of the East Carolina Pirates. He's our guest taking dead aim. Let's look back a little bit. A year ago, and now we look to now, was it harder, easier, or about what you expected in terms of coming into the program when you did late last summer and taking over as head coach?
Well, I think it was difficult because it was late last summer. And the challenge really was getting to know 10 players who I hadn't really spent hardly any time with and them getting to know us. So from a coaching staff this year, the thing that excites us most is all of our returning players. I mean, we've spent a good year with them. Our four freshmen, we spent a lot of time getting to know them in the recruiting process and watching them play. So we feel like from a coaching standpoint, we've got a much better grasp on how each individual needs to be coached and what each individual's strengths and weaknesses are. So we can kind of attack those right now as opposed to try to feel everybody out for the fall semester.
Glad you brought up the relationship aspect. I have felt, and I know that we've probably discussed this before, that the relationship between a coach and his players on a college golf team is really much more intimate than a lot of sports, for sure. And it's almost like a parental relationship. With that in mind, you know, one of the key things is trust. How long did you think for you it took before the guys who you didn't recruit and you didn't sign before, they trusted you?
I mean, I think it was part of just an ongoing process, probably throughout the fall.
Yeah.
And trust isn't necessarily the word, because it makes it seem like they mistrusted you if you didn't trust you. But it was just the getting to know each other, them getting to know how we coach as a staff, us getting to know, you know, what their good and bad habits were from a practice and growing standpoint. But just getting to know them as people, because, I mean, we coach a team sport, but it's all about really coaching 11 individuals on our team, because everybody has a different need than somebody else. So, and everybody's buttons get pushed a little bit differently. Some guys you need to pat on the back. Sometimes you need to give somebody a kick in the rear, and it's trying to figure out who will respond to which better.
Let's talk about those people for a second. In a word, as I look at your roster, you are Y-O-U-N-G young. Four true freshmen.
Yes, we are.
One redshirt freshman, two sophomores, three juniors. Coach, half your team's going through the major life adjustment of just going to college. That's a lot, isn't it?
It is, but it's exciting, too. I mean, at our first team meeting this year, I sat there and I said, you know, guys, the exciting thing is every one of you is going to be in this room next year. But I don't want us to wait. I want this year to be the year we do some special things. Just because all of you are going to be here next year doesn't mean I want to wait till next year to do something spectacular. So it is exciting. We're young, but I would say we're fairly experienced, because so many of our returning players got starts last year. Obviously, we have two players returning who were all-conference, and Patrick Stevenson and Blake Taylor, who basically played in every single tournament they've played as a Pirate. But we've got a lot of other experience. And our freshman class is very experienced. Each one of them, they've either won a state junior championship, a team state high school championship, or an individual state high school championship. So they know how to win. So they're just coming in here trying to get adjusted to college life. And then once they get that down, they'll get back to their winning ways.
You got Addy and Connor, AJ and Jack. Those are your Fab Four freshmen. Let's talk about Stephen Carroll and Tim Button. Between the two of them, they gave you 27 rounds in competition last year. Obviously, a lot more expected of them this year. Have you seen their game progress in the last year?
Well, I think both of them have grown tremendously. I mean, Tim last year from fall to spring had the most amount of growth I've probably seen in a college player, to where he wasn't really even close in the fall to starting for us to pretty much starting all spring. So that just shows how much he developed, but it also kind of shows you what the adjustment process can be like. Stephen Carroll has improved tremendously from this time last year to now. He went out and won our first qualifier this spring. He had a good summer, but he just has a much better attitude, and he's really worked hard on that. And we've been harping on him for the past 8 or 9 months about going out there with a positive attitude and forgetting the bad shots and moving on, and he's done a great job with that. So it's been fun to see both of those young men progress, because we'll count on them a lot, because we do have starting experience, and losing two full-time starters from last year, and Tim Conover and Jackson Spires, we need those young guys to step up.
Andrew Sapp is the head men's golf coach of the ECU Pirates, our guest taking dead aim. Logan Schuping is giving you some rounds. And Jimbo Stanley's a redshirt. And I imagine that after being on campus for a year and doing everything with the team but not being able to play, he's got to be chomping at the bit to get in the fight.
He is. He's excited. I think last year was definitely a growing year for him. And we're excited that having him redshirt last year, he still has 4 years of eligibility left. So He's playing better. He's got more confidence, and he's going to keep growing. But it is nice that we didn't waste a year of eligibility last year near the end of the spring, and that he chose the red shirt. And so he's got all that learning curve behind him now. So he's ready to get off to the races.
Just looking at the stats and having the privilege of talking with Blake Taylor this summer, there's no question that he and Patrick Stevenson are your team leaders. You've already brought them up. Are they more leaders by example? Are they verbal leaders, a little of both?
Well, that's one thing that we're trying to get them to adjust to. In the past, when you had three seniors and they were just sophomores,
yeah,
I mean, they would just go about their business and kind of do their thing and be more leaders by example. But now, this year, we've kind of called upon them to, you know, be a little more verbal about their leadership because they're the ones with the experience. And they're the ones who can, you know, help encourage players from their good and their bad experiences as college golfers. So we can tell them as coaches story after story with our 30-plus years of head coaching experience, but when you hear it from a guy that you live with or you ride to practice with every day, it can sometimes be a whole lot more powerful. So, yeah, we're trying to get them this year and next year to be more vocal leaders, which I think they'll both step into very well.
Coach, a little bit more about Blake. Like I said, I talked with him this summer. You helped facilitate that. This game is so much about confidence, and you know this. I would think doing as well as he did at the Greenbrier this summer, playing in a PGA Tour event, it has to have this kid flying 10 feet off the ground and feeling like he can do anything. I mean, at this point, he's got to be walking onto every range, every course, every mess hall, feeling like, man, I don't just belong here. I'm the alpha dog in this place. And that can do nothing but propel this kid and your team, right?
Absolutely. Honestly, it's helped the other guys on the team. Because they've seen a guy who they practice with and play with on a daily basis get into a PGA Tour event, get to play with the best players in the world, and they're like, wow, I mean, that could be me. So it's given everybody on this team a boost of confidence, not just Blake. I mean, obviously, it gave Blake a taste of what it's like, so that can make you even more hungry. But, I mean, that kind of just spread throughout the rest of the team, too. Because they're like, man, I see my buddy playing in a PGA Tour event. I want to get some of that.
Coach Andrew Sapp is the head men's golf coach of the East Carolina Pirates, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about your schedule a little bit. This fall, you've added a tournament going from 4 to 5 this year as compared to last. And with the exception of heading to Tennessee, you're staying in the state in the spring, significantly more travel. Is this done on purpose to sort of ease into things, or is that just the way it worked out?
Absolutely. I mean, the plan all along with 11 guys from North Carolina and a young team, we're playing in great events. I mean, we're playing Duke's tournament, Wake Forest tournament, NC State's tournament. UNCG hosts a great event, and East Tennessee State hosts a great event, and we played in that last year. So we were trying to get on familiar territory early on because with young guys, if we've got freshmen in the starting lineup, they probably played all these golf courses or at least are used to the types of grasses that we will play on if they haven't played them. So it is on purpose that we set up our fall schedule this way so that it hopefully would ease the transition for this young team. And it's nice because it's like we have four home events because we're familiar with these golf courses. Obviously, there's a home team playing in the events, so it's not a home event, but being close to home for us, especially for all of our North Carolina guys, should benefit them. And when we've got teams coming from all over the country to play in these tournaments, it should give us an advantage.
Oh, well, that's what I was going to say. It's not like the, you know, between Duke, Wakes, and State's tournament. I've seen the fields for those. It's not like Chop Liver is coming into play right in these events. You've got some top flight teams from all over the country. You're going to have a pretty good idea about what you have after you come out of the fall.
Well, the goal, really, after the fall is to be a top 25, top 30 team. So that in the spring, you're just going out to try to win tournaments. You're not trying to worry about being a bubble team to make it to NCAA regionals. So our schedule sets us up for that. Now we just have to go out and play well. Because if we play well, we're going to beat some teams who are going to be playing in the postseason. And if you want to play in the postseason, that's what you have to do. So we've got the schedule set up for that. And if you get off to a hot fall so often, that just kind of spills itself into the spring season and you're kind of off to the races.
He is the head men's golf coach for ECU. That is Andrew Sapp. And when we return, we'll stay on campus, but a little closer to home as Ryan Cabbage, head men's golf coach of Charlotte, takes dead aim at his 2018-2019 49er squad and schedule. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey, we're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors, and now joined by the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers, Ryan Cabbage.
Coach, one of my favorite things about you is that, at least in recent years, it seems like half your roster is rooting for the European Ryder Cup team. You've got three guys from Great Britain and Ireland, and I'm always amused at the notion of somebody like John Boucher from Dublin trying to understand Trey Tobias from Tennessee. Anyway, I was wondering, do those guys from GB and I, do they go home for the summer? Do they stay here? Is it a little of both?
They'll actually go home. Once we finish, exams and NCAAs. Each spring, and they'll play a full schedule in Europe over the course of the summer. And the guys played well. Harvey Byers from England picked up a win this summer, and John Goff finished second in the Irish Am, which was a fantastic showing there. So they'll still play, equal to the number of events that our guys that are here in the States, over the course of the summer. They'll play five or six times. Just to kind of stay sharp with their game before coming back in August.
Now, I've talked to amateurs and professionals alike from this country who go over to play in Great Britain and Ireland for various amateur events and tournaments and whatnot, and they talk about it, that it takes them a week or two just to get adjusted to the grasses and the way the ball sits up and the way things react. And, you can get – there's American-style golf courses over there, don't get me wrong. But, the links-style golf, does it take a period of time once they come back from a whole summer of playing over there to readjust to, say, the American style of golf?
It does. The transition time becomes shorter and shorter as they progress through their career. But as they come over, that first August when they arrive, it is much different. Golf courses, obviously a little bit softer here in the States. The biggest thing is the Bermuda rough that we see here in the Charlotte area. And especially when they get back in August. It's pretty thick and trying to judge, how balls are going to come out of that rough. Is it going to fly on you? Is it going to come out a little bit dead? That's probably the biggest thing, with second shots into greens, kind of judging that rough and then also chipping, around the greens. Obviously in the States with the golf courses that we play, the ball's pitched up in the air a lot more than it is over there in Europe. So, it generally a week, maybe 10 days, and then they kind of get back on track and get everything sorted out. So it doesn't really affect – I wouldn't say it doesn't affect their tournament performance because they have it figured out soon after getting back.
Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers, our guest taking dead aim. I mentioned Trey Tobias earlier. He's new to the roster this year as a sophomore in transfer.
He did. Trey was his freshman year was over at Walter State Community College in Morristown, Tennessee, junior college there, and he was a first-team junior college All-American. So he comes, having had a fantastic freshman year there at Walter State. The biggest thing for Trey right now is that transition from, even though he had a terrific year, there is a difference, obviously, in JUCO golf. Versus now at the highest level of Division I golf. And I think having that understanding and knowing, that the standard is a bit higher, but certainly he had a great year there at Walter State, and we're excited to have him in our program here at Charlotte now.
Coach, you got three sophomores, two juniors, and three freshmen. As I look at your roster, similar to what I said to Coach Sapp at ECU, this fall you are Young.
We are. And you know, it's exciting. These guys have done a terrific job in their 2 weeks now on campus. Ben Woodruff and Carson Ormby have stepped right in and have certainly made us better from a competitive standpoint. You know, but we are young with no seniors on our roster. You know, the three freshmen, three sophomores, two juniors. But that's not always a bad thing. You know, I think we have the opportunity to really put a foundation in place, you know, over the next few years here. The talent level is certainly there, and I've shared with these guys that we have more than enough talent to be successful. But it's what we do with that talent. But thus far, like I said, through the first couple of weeks, the energy level has been good. Team chemistry is fantastic with these guys. They're fun to be around. And I think as long as we are able to control the things that we have control over, which is that energy level, that team chemistry, you know, making sure that we're kind of looking after and taking care of each other and doing things that we need to do in order to be successful as individuals, you know, then this team, even though young, I still think we have an opportunity to be really good.
You know, you brought up a word that I really like, and that word is opportunity. I mean, you lost Connor Purcell and Tyler Young off of last year's squad. That's 57 competitive rounds between the two of them. And somebody would look at that and might say, well, my God, that's a big spot to fill. But I think when you're a competitor, you look at that as an opportunity that, hey, that's 57 rounds that someone needs to play and someone needs to excel in. And if you're a competitor, man, that I feel like that your juices get flowing. It opens the door for you to feel like, well, I need to fill that role.
For sure. You know, I think as a golf coach, you know, you always want your program to be in a position to where every spot has to be earned and that every spot in the lineup is difficult to earn as well. You know, the old saying, you're only as strong as your weakest link. I'm not sure that there's another sport that is more true than in golf. And if we're able to be good enough, that every week the three guys that we leave at home that do not travel with us, if those are terrific, top-notch players that we're leaving behind that are on top of their game, and we just happen to have five guys that are playing a little bit better at that time, then we're going to be okay from a competitive standpoint. But, you know, these guys, and I feel like at this point we have that. You know, we've got a few guys that need to continue to progress and to get better. But I do think that it's going to be competitive week in and week out throughout the course of the year.
Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers, our guest taking Dead Aim. I want to talk to you about sophomores. I think they're the most fascinating because when you're a freshman, and we've talked about this before, there's more than just being a D1 athlete to adjust to. For the most part, their whole life and paradigm of doing things is different. And for each, the time of comfort and transition is different. So I always look at the second year as the one where you could see the biggest jump in improvement. Bringing up Armstead and Byers, they're not entirely inexperienced. They give you 18 rounds last year, but what have you seen in their games grow for the better since they got on campus?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in Harvey's case, I think physically he's just better than he was when he was here last spring. And now, in fairness to him, from a transition standpoint, he came over in January. So he's really only been with us one semester, although he's a sophomore eligibility-wise. You know, that's a tough thing to step into. You hop off the plane in January and right away, you know, we're off and running, with that. And so he physically is better now, than he was last year. His ball striking is better. His putting is better. Overall, he's just a better player. Connor Armistead is a guy that, will continue to grow. He's a student of the game. You know, and is always studying, trying to sort out ways to improve and to get better. But no, I've been very happy with both of those guys. And it's something that, yeah, I'm sure we've talked about it before. As I look over a 4-year progression, the biggest transition is, like you said, we've talked about the freshmen and the world is kind of flipped upside down on them. They're trying to figure out which way is which and how to sort through that. A lot of times the challenge for those sophomores is that they think that they have it figured out in year two. In reality, though, they don't quite have it figured out. You know, so we have to make sure that those guys in that second year, you know, remain coachable, remain open to thoughts and ideas that are going to help them to get better. Because sometimes when guys think that they have it figured out and they don't, that's kind of a dangerous combination because they don't want to listen quite as much. I don't sense that at all with Harvey and Connor, but it's something that we always keep an eye on with our sophomores. But so far, like I said, I've been very pleased with Connor and Harvey, and look for both of those guys to have good years for us.
You know, there's such a great parallel between being a college golf coach and being a parent by what you just said. How many times as parents do we look at our kids, and they, especially once they reach a certain age, and they think they got it all figured out and they've got all the answers, and you just have to sort of stand by and be there when they figure out that, no, they really don't have all the answers.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's no old saying in parenting, if you always pick up your child's shoes, they never learn to pick their shoes up themselves. Very similar in coaching. It's difficult sometimes to know what someone is doing is most likely not going to lead them to success, but also having that understanding of knowing, okay, I'm going to have to let them do it this way this time, even though it's not going to work, so that therefore they're better for it down the road. But funny you mentioned, because I've always often thought, you know, as a parent and as a coach, the parallels that run. That's a very good, valid point that you make there.
Coach, let's talk about your schedule a little bit. You've got a couple of changes this fall. What goes into your thinking when it comes to dropping one or two and adding a new tournament?
We've got a few staples that have been there for years. The Minnesota event that we're leaving for in just a few days. Birmingham with the Alabama event and then Royal Oaks in Dallas. From there, Tim Straub at Davidson, he's always had an event at River Run. This year it's actually moved to the fall. And when that opportunity came open, you know, with that and it was available in terms of the dates there, that was really a no brainer for us. And then adding the University of Louisville tournament, it's an NCAA regional site. Sort of give us an opportunity to see the golf course, kind of get a little pre-NCAA practice run, so to speak, with that. So that's kind of how we went about with the fall schedule. For the most part, you know, it's a pretty simple recipe in regards to the quality of the golf course and the quality of the field. You know, if those two match up, you know, which we feel very comfortable in with any event that we play in that's on our schedule that we've checked both of those boxes, then that's what we look to do. We're fortunate to have the resources here with our administration and athletic department to be able to do some traveling and to get some different parts of the country to be able to play, you know, what has been over the course of the past really 8 to 10 years, a top 35 schedule in terms of strength of schedule in the country. And so there are a lot of variables that go into that, but certainly a great opportunity as we come back to that magic word of opportunity for our kids to find out, you know, how good we are. And we're going to find out immediately in Minnesota, you know, where we stack up, because there's some highly ranked, you know, national teams there, probably 10 to 12 teams deep. You know, so this will be one of the stronger fields that we see all year coming up in just a few days.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at, the fields for not just Minnesota, but Louisville. And you're not the first coach to tell me we wanted to go there because it's the NCAA site. They're going to have a really strong field. Alabama and Dallas, always huge fields. But, you know, we get sort of south centric and southeast centric in our thinking. And then you watch the NCAA tournaments and you realize, God, Illinois has a great program. God, Michigan has a great program. Notre Dame has a great program. And these are the kind of schools that are going to be at that Minnesota tournament, and you may not run into them the rest of the year, but I think it's really cool that you get a chance to see what they have to offer early.
We do, and you know, ultimately our goal is to play in an NCAA championship on a regional level and advance to the NCAA finals, and in doing so, you know, those are the type teams that we're going to have to beat to get there eventually. And so ultimately our goal, as we talked about, great golf courses, great competition. But when we get to an NCAA regional, I don't want the first time that our guys see Baylor or Alabama or Oklahoma State or whoever, you know, some of the national, you know, traditional teams, I don't want it to be the first time that we see those guys in May to where maybe there is a little bit of that wow factor or whatever that it might be. So we see those guys in September. We see them in October. We see them in, you know, April. We see them in March, whatever it might be. So then you try to make that NCAA regional and then hopefully the NCAA finals just like a regular event. And then they look around and, oh, okay, there's that team. And over here is this other team. Okay, let's get back to our business here with that. So, but yeah, we'll see a lot of great teams throughout the course of the year for sure. And that's what we want. You know, I've never shied away from that competition with our program because I do think that it gives you an opportunity to sort of grade yourself and find out, okay, where do we stack up? Where do we need to improve in order to make up some ground on those guys? And then hopefully you see as you progress through the year that you are making up some ground, that you're working on the right things, doing things the right way, and that you are continuing to get better so that you're building up momentum as you get into that April conference championship, May NCAA championship, and then hopefully into the finals in late May and early June.
Yeah, I don't care who you are or what sport you're in. I've never heard a coach say I got better playing against weaker competition. Get you out of here on this. Ryan Cabbage is the head men's golf coach, Charlotte 49ers, our guest taking Dead Aim. Realistically speaking, I mean, you know, good God, the tournaments in Dallas and Alabama and Minnesota, and I mean, these are really strong tournaments. You have a very young team. Realistically speaking, when we talk again at the first of 2019, looking back at the fall, what would you consider to be very successful for this group?
Yeah, I think our main, objective, we've got some benchmark goals that are in place that are more process-oriented, things that our guys know that we have control over to where measuring whether or not you beat this team or you know, and by how many strokes did you beat that team, or if you lost to that team and how many strokes they beat you by, we can measure against ourselves on a daily basis. We know what it takes to be successful and what we're capable of. So I would want to be able just to measure our guys against where they are or where they were, you know, August the 18th, 19th, when they moved on to campus and we started this season through the third week in October when we finished the tournament in Dallas. Are we better on that day than we were back in August? That will be my main objective. You know, if that leads to two wins this fall or three wins this fall or five middle of the pack finishes, then we'll take that. But we want to measure ourselves against those benchmark goals, making sure that we continue to get better because, you know, ultimately, if we're able to continue to do that, and we only talk in terms of from, you know, August when they came on campus until the end of October, but now you do that again, you know, throughout the course of the year, by the time you get to Texarkana in April, we have the opportunity to be a really good team. And ultimately, that's the goal, is to just continue to get better. I think we've got some things in place, as I mentioned before, to have some measurables there to where we know, are we or are we not? And so that's going to be the main objective. If you and I talked the 1st of November after we finished the fall season, and we can look back and go, okay, yes, we have improved in these areas, and we're moving in the right direction, then I'm going to be happy with that.
He's the head men's golf coach of the Charlotte 49ers. That's Ryan Cabbage. I'd also like to thank the head men's golf coach at ECU, Andrew Sapp, and the great John Feinstein, author of the new book, The Prodigy, for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. And weather-wise, the days are getting shorter and unfortunately not cooler yet, but still looks like a good weekend in the Carolinas to get your golf on. So if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.